Hello and welcome to this special Big Boat interview. My name is Lucy Dunn and I'm the Content Director at Boat. Today I have the privilege of talking to Richard Wiese, adventurer, producer and President Emeritus of the venerable institution, the Explorers Club. Now Richard seems to have adventure hardwired into his DNA. His globe-trotting parents took him to some of the world's most far-flung places starting at an early age, including climbing Mount Kilimanjaro at the tender age of just 11. Since then, he has made adventure and exploration his life and career, and along the way was host and executive producer for the Emmy Award-winning series Born to Explore. And when it comes to exploration, what hasn't he done? He's dug for dinosaurs in Canada, cross-country skied the North Pole, tracked wild camels in Australia, conquered the Seven Summits, tagged jaguars in Yucatan jungles, discovered 29 new life forms on Kilimanjaro, and he's participated in the largest ever medical expedition on Mount Everest. And if that wasn't enough, Wiese should also be singled out for his remarkable tenure at the Explorers Club. He has been elected its president no less than 7 times, more times than anyone else in its 118-year history. And his position means that he's met some of the world's most intrepid travellers along the way, many of them household names. And I'm hoping he'll tell us who. So without further ado, let's meet him and find out. So hello, Richard.
Hi, Lucy. Lucy, you forgot one of the many things that I've done is this morning I've made breakfast for my 3 kids, teenagers, and had to yell at them to get on the bus. And when they missed the bus, I had to drive them to school, which meant I yelled
okay.
even more.
So, yes, you've been busy.
Well, you know, yes, I am busy. And I don't think I'm any busier than any other parent. Yeah. And so I just happen to have a different career.
Yes,
than
you
most
certainly
dads.
Do. So tell me a bit more about it. How did you become an explorer?
You know, I don't know if anybody ever sets out to be an explorer. My father was an airline pilot. He was a 747 captain. He was also the first man to solo the Pacific Ocean in an airplane, which was never really a big deal in my house growing up because my father was a very modest person. But I think that where I was extremely lucky was that I had 2 parents that really let their children engage in their dreams. I had a father and an uncle who was the head of MIT's nuclear engineering department as mentors. And so my father, for example, wasn't so into sport where other fathers may just watch football or baseball games with their sons or daughters. But we would stand on the lawn of our home, and he started aviation with celestial navigation, and we talked about the stars. Or when there was a hurricane offshore where I lived growing up on Long Island, we would go down to the ocean to either swim in the big waves or watch them, or if there were frozen lakes or ponds. So at a very young age, I was, you know, just so always outside doing stuff. And I know that's kind of changing now since most kids seem to spend more time indoors. But because of the particular area that I lived in, didn't have very many kids my age, almost none. I just spent hours in the woods and on the water with my dogs and just, you know, just pretending that I was out in the wilderness. If it snowed, I pretended I was in the Arctic. Long Island's pretty flat, but I'd find some cliffs down at the beach and pretend I was roped up to Mount Everest. And so that's how it all started.
And you had childhood heroes that you followed?
I did. I had sports heroes like many people, but at that time, you know, I was sort of right in the middle of the Apollo era when people were going to land on the moon. So I used to follow the astronaut stuff. I mean, to me, those were the greatest heroes on Earth. I had heroes like Sir Edmund Hillary. And Jane Goodall was big on television at that point. And I can tell you in my wildest dreams, did I ever think that I would meet those people, host those people, be sitting at lunches with those people or riding in cars with them. And so I've had so many pinch me moments where I've seen people who've really written the pages of history and got a chance through my involvement with the Explorers Club to actually meet these people and be on some sort of collegial level with them. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And coming back, so as you mentioned in the, as I mentioned in the intro, you produced and directed the Emmy Award winning series, Born to Explore. So for listeners who are not familiar with the series, can you explain?
How dare they? They can go on Amazon.
How dare they? Is it on Amazon? You can insert your plug now.
In America.
Okay.
But so like many other people who've worked for other people, you always say, my boss is an idiot and I can do it better. And I never forget that I was flying over the Northern Territory of Australia with my cameraman and friend, John Barnhart. And we were like, man, if we did a show, we would do this and this and this and this. And so I went out and I pitched the show to ABC, which is a local network, not local, national network in America. They liked it. And it was interesting because usually negotiations are about money. But for me, to have editorial control was super important. And so that made all the difference in the world. And then I assembled a team that I thought was socially conscious, super smart, and into the subject matter. And we were very self-critical, and we made 208 episodes of this show. Our first year on air, again, another blow-me-away moment, was when we were nominated for a Daytime Emmy, which is, you know, a big award in the United States. And I remember one year we got 5 nominations, more than any other television show in that sort of genre of, you know, documentaries, nature. And so it was a really fulfilling experience. And I think really what made it more fulfilling is it became as much about the culture of the people we met along the way than it was about me pounding my chest and saying, aren't I a superhero? Or, you know, looking at animals sort of tearing each other apart. We found the most interesting characters were people from life. And so we felt that we gave voice to many unspoken or underrepresented cultures. We learned their stories, and, you know, we felt very proud that we represented them sort of in that glass half full. So I really enjoyed the experience. It made me a better person, made me probably more socially conscious. And so, yes, it was a great experience.
So could you tell me who you met, any people that you met that you still, you know, still remember, still
yes.
keep in touch with?
Yeah, there are a few people, and I take back memories from virtually every single shoot. And I'll tell you a couple that just come to mind, top of mind. I met this woman in South Africa who at age 12 ran away from her village because she was meant to marry a much older man. She was Zulu, didn't want to marry him. So she ran away from home, went to this other village. And even though she didn't have a formal education, she always vowed that she would start a school there for other kids so they could have that opportunity. And so this woman showed me this tree, and she said, this tree was my classroom. I taught kindergarten, and this tree was first grade, and this was second, third. And she said, I would get the smartest first grader to teach the kindergarten, the first smartest second grader, the first grade, and so on. And I thought, if this woman were a CEO in the UK or in America, she would be a giant. I mean, just kind of forces of nature. Or I met another woman who was the only professional fishing woman in all of Chile. And every morning she takes her boat out onto the Pacific Ocean. It's actually taken out by horses out onto the ocean. She fishes by herself, and she hasn't taken a day off in the last 18 years. And so when I went out with her, my assumption would be that she'd be a really hardened woman. And so when the cameras were on, she became like Meryl Streep. She came animated and this. And I thought, wow, here's this woman who, you know, has had a tough life, but man, great sense of humor. You know, other people in the Atacama Desert in Chile, where super tough environment, but the first thing they do is offer you, you know, their food. Or, you know, I've been through the Middle East quite a few times. Morocco comes to mind, where you learn about desert hospitality and that whole three cups of tea. So that's why I am especially disturbed when I hear about fighting around the world, because there is no culture of people that is inherently evil. Most people want the same things in terms of feeding their kids and safety and, you know, all of those things.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it was a great lesson. But I mean, the biggest lesson from a television perspective was it didn't have to be all about me pounding my chest saying I'm a super explorer. You know, you could have some humility and, you know, obviously I didn't know the answer to everything.
But coming back, I mean, the testosterone thing, but was there any hair-raising moments that you can remember? I'm sure there are a few.
not necessarily on that show. And I always say the mark of a really great explorer, and I'll use a sailing analogy, is if you're a great sailor, you don't wait until a thunderstorm is on top of you to show your survival skills. You see those dark clouds on the horizon and you leave. And so I think that I have had some quote hairy experiences or situations that I felt were not comfortable. And those are generally, everybody gets the same feeling. The hands get kind of sweaty and that's sort of like your gut. And so I have all my fingers, you know, from extensive Arctic travel and Antarctic travel. I have all my toes. No frostbite on the nose. I think that risk is inherent, but I try to avoid it.
You try and avoid it. Yeah, well, true. You know, yeah.
Listen, to me, you know, recently a friend of mine perished in that Triton submarine, a submersible accident off the Titanic, Hamish Harding. And to me, the worst death is somebody sitting in their chair, you know, thinking about all the things they should have done in their life. And while I was not happy about his death for sure, and he was a close friend, you know, I recognize that humans have that innate curiosity to see beyond, you know, their own backyard.
And how do you think that coming to the Titan, because obviously that was such a terrible news event this year.
Sure.
But how do you think the tragedy... for adventures tourism in particular, how do you think the tragedy has affected that industry?
Well, oddly enough, after the Challenger blew up the spacecraft, more people wanted to be astronauts because now it was perceived a heroic or dangerous thing. I found that from a male perspective, a lot of males want like Hemingway without the hangover. They want to do things that are perceived dangerous or rugged. I think similar to the aviation industry, you learn from your mistakes. Even when the Titanic itself went down, after that accident, there were new safety laws and inspections and all sorts of things came about that made sailing a safer industry. So I think with any tragedy, if you don't learn from your mistakes or come out of that tragedy better, it will have been, you know, a pointless exercise.
And personally, has it made you think about adventure in a different way, or change your mind about being in dangerous situations?
I mean, yes.
Obviously, you mitigate that as in is a professional explorer.
Yeah. So, Lucy, I've seen this movie before. You know, I've had many friends who've died on Everest or on other mountains or in the Arctic or out at sea. Probably more to cancer or car accidents. You know, for me, the biggest, I guess, change is that I have kids. So I feel an immense responsibility to raising my children. And, you know, I'm getting older. And I think that that's where the ego has to be tempered and you have to truly assess the situation. I think I was talking to a friend of mine just before we got on, and he's a great underwater archaeologist, and he was out on his mountain bike on the beach where he lives, and he fell. Now he's, I know, around 80 years old. And so in his head, he's still, you know, 40 or 50, and you know, that adventure still is in him. But man, you gotta always assess the situation.
Yeah. Well, coming back to the Explorers Club, so you are the longest serving president of the Explorers Club. So can you tell me a bit more about the Explorers Club, what its mission is, and can anyone become a member?
So its mission is to promote exploration and science by all possible means. It was started in 1904 by a bunch of then men trying to get to be the first to the North Pole. And when you walk into the lobby of the Explorers Club, you'll see a sign. Our members are the first to the North Pole, South Pole, to the Mariana Trench, first on the surface of the moon, and first on Everest. So our members, you know, as we started earlier, are really the people that turn the pages of history. In order to be a member, you have to be elected by, you know, a pretty stringent membership committee. And they're not looking for people who've necessarily climbed Mount Everest. They would be as interested in somebody who's studied butterflies in Hyde Park in England, or has, you know, filled in missing bits of information somewhere along the way. So you don't have to do something big and heroic. You just have to have contributed to science. And so I joined in 1989, and I remember walking into its headquarters. It was like Harry Potter's Hogwarts for adults. I heard people talking about spear tips in the Amazon, people walking on the moon, spacewalks, all of this stuff. And I almost instantly said, this is my tribe. This is really the kind of people I want to hang out with, because instead of saying, I went to the Atacama Desert in Chile, I wouldn't have to say where the Atacama is or it's the driest place on Earth. They'd already know that. They'd ask me if I stayed at this place or that place, or I met that person. So for me, it's some of my best friends. It's also a lot of alpha individuals, so it's like herding cats, because everybody is an expedition leader. And I always say being president of the Explorers Club is like being like a Roman emperor. It usually doesn't end well.
Yeah. And do you often bump into people that we'd know, that famous names? I mean, you mentioned Sir Edmund Hillary, I think, at the beginning. Anyone else you'd like to name drop?
I don't bump into Ed Hillary anymore.
No. Obviously.
But I will say this, and it doesn't happen as much as it used to, but every once in a while my phone would ring and I'd look up and it'd say Buzz Aldrin. And if I was with somebody, I'd go, and I'd get on the phone and talk to him. And so, you know, there are heads of state that have come through the Explorers Club, governors, senators. You know, there's a lot of people that it still holds a big attraction to. And so, you know, I remember at the Explorers Club annual dinner, which has exotic foods, eating tarantulas with Jeff Bezos.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, there are some pretty big hitters out there. Or, you know, I mean, gosh, the few times that I've taken Jane Goodall, which she probably doesn't remember, but I certainly do, around the club, you know, it's you may be cool on the outside, but inside you're going, wow, this is so cool.
Yeah.
So there is that element of that's so cool still in my life.
And the tarantula, was it fried?
Yeah. So if you put sugar on anything, and here's the secret to eating tarantulas. And this happened to me once on a news show, because they wanted to do something on the exotic foods we ate. And so that, you know, they had the termites, you know, and then they had tarantulas. However, the tarantulas have these fuzzy legs, and sometimes people get them sort of stuck in their throat and they have a little infection. So I was on this news show and the host wanted to show off before they were going to go to break how they really loved it, and just shoveled all these in her mouth. And I could see her reaction that she wasn't going to be able to talk. So I saw the teleprompter and I sort of finished what was on her teleprompter, and then they got her water and so forth. So yes, that's the dangers of eating tarantula, if one must know. And the other food that I would say is a huge joke from the Viking tradition is rotten shark. They give you this fermented shark that literally smells like you've left your fishing bait in your bucket for a few weeks, and it just has that sort of ammonia kind of smell to it. And it tastes just like it smells. And I could swear to you, the Icelandic people do this to tourists to somehow, you know, create some sort of reputation. It's horrible food, not to be eaten.
But it might be good for the gut.
You know, everybody always says, oh, yes, well, you know, I hear this is good for you. And I go, who's they? You know, probably same information as from Dr. Google.
Yes, exactly. The world has been traveled extensively. So why do you think exploration is still important? And are there still places left to explore? And
that
where?
Is such a great question. And so, yes, we may have thought that we have seen the world, but the paradigms of my childhood have shifted tremendously. When I was born, there were 9 planets and life existed in a very narrow band between above freezing, below boiling. We know there's more than 9 planets, though the 9th planet is in question, Pluto. We know that extremophiles are a lot more prolific than we once thought. And so I can give you even, I'll give you a fact right now that might actually blow your mind.
Go on.
It's something you've seen time and time again. How many times have you looked at the horizon at a rising moon and thought, oh my gosh, that moon looks huge, right?
Yeah, yes.
And so that's actually called the full moon illusion. It's only an optical illusion or a trick of your brain that if you actually took a photo of it, and a lot of people do, and they're always disappointed that it looks smaller kind of in the photo than it does when they're looking at it. And, you know, I've met a psychologist who spent his career trying to explain that phenomena. So that's something that you see every day that now, if I tell you that, you'll look at that full moon or go like that with your thumb or something, and you'll see it is not the size you think it is, because when you look up at its higher, and it's just really a result of your brain equating things on the horizon to be closer than things straight up. You know, they're using DNA, they're using LIDAR to find civilizations. We're learning that maybe people traveled more extensively across the Earth. So I think the amount of information that's being disseminated is at a record pace. When Darwin first did his expedition of discovery on the Beagle, it took, you know, probably 10 years before he started writing about it and 20 years before people started discussing. I think now with the internet, the sharing of information is so much greater. I think the whole idea of astrophysics or cosmology is mind-bending. I mean, you look out there and then you start seeing how big and how fast and all of that stuff. I am in awe of people who can actually explain that.
Would you go into space?
You know, I would not on the current configuration of just going up and, you know, these suborbitals. Everybody I know who's gone to space and orbited the Earth said there's something called an overview effect in which you look down at the Earth and you get this profound feeling, you know, especially when you think that every person that's ever existed on Earth was all there. And they said you get this overly protective, beautiful feeling of love towards this planet. And that would be the way I'd want to go to space. I think right now, you know, people who are just sort of, you know, spending $1 million to go into space while, you know, might be kind of fun for about 15 minutes. It's not what I want to do. And I also think you're going to see in some short time, unfortunately, a tragedy where some celebrity dies in space because they'll have an accident. I mean, that's what's coming down the road.
Yeah. What about back down to Earth? What are there still places to explore?
Yes. So I'll give you an example. About 10 years ago, I went into New York Central Park with 500 scientists and volunteers. And our mission was to catalog as many forms of life as we could within a 24-hour period. It's called a BioBlitz, which is a term for a rapid biological assessment. And so what we discovered was a new millipede that had never been identified to science. And on a microbial level, extremophiles, we had discovered 202 new forms of life never identified to science. So in one of the most urban, walked across parks that was in the world, we found new life. And so if you extrapolate that out to the world of extremophiles, there is so many things to discover. You know, in Yellowstone Park, they have those famous geysers, right? Mm-hmm. Those hot thermal pools. And from extremophiles in there, that's how they first learned how to amplify DNA, which they use in criminal cases, just from those. There are extremophiles that grow in, you know, along diamond veins, or extremophiles that only grow around gold. And so I think there's a lot of medical uses that you'll find. It might be the next rainforest will be coming out of extremophiles. I think in the world of paleontology, we're getting a more complete picture every year of these mythical creatures that were on Earth. You know, we're learning to recognize the signals and signs that about our own Earth. And there's sort of a saying in science, science doesn't care what your beliefs are. And so, you know, in present day here, especially in America, science is under siege as a alternative thought. And I laugh at these people. You know, I mean, it is scientists aren't, they don't have a political agenda necessarily. They're just trying to look at what's in front of them and making the best assessment they can with the information at hand.
Mm.
And I'll get off my stool by step on that way.
just for the record, could you just explain what extremophile is? Just so.
Yes.
That...
So it is an organism that lives in an extreme environment. For example,
okay, right.
In a volcanic vent, you're going to have microbial creatures that are in high acid or high temperatures. You might have in the bottom of the ocean under extreme pressure, which is an extreme thing, you will have microbes that live. You at the bottom of a nuclear reactor, there might be a sort of microbe that lives.
Mm-hmm.
You could even have an extremophile that lives in the bottom of your toilet. I don't know. I mean, microorganisms are all around us. And again, I don't know if this data point I'm giving you is exactly right, but we've cataloged approximately 1 million different forms of life. It's estimated that there are 1 million, and it's estimated that there's over 200 million forms of life, which means mm-hmm. we haven't even cataloged 1% of all life forms on Earth.
Wow. And under the sea.
Well, the sea is, you know, to me, the greatest close mystery to us.
Yes, I think you're right. I think you're right. In terms of, so I don't know if there is a country that you haven't been to. Tell me where.
All right. So I'm going to preface this first by saying I once had a guy come up to my office, president's office of the Explorers Club. He had been to every country except for, I think, North Korea in about under a 2-year period. He was so proud of himself. And I thought, this is so pathetic. What did you actually see? You know, did you experience a romance in Paris? Did you smell the dust off the pyramids of Egypt? You know, did you, you know, sit there and ponder the floor of the Colosseum? You know, so this whole idea of bucket list travel to me is kind of a little sad. Instead of saying, you know, like, for example, Rome, I've been there throughout my life with my grandparents, with a girlfriend, hopefully someday with my wife. And I've always experienced that country or Paris or London through a different lens, depending on where I was in life. So I have been to a lot of countries. I don't know how many, and you know, there are a few big glaring gaps in my travel. I have never been to Greenland. I've flown over it to England several times, and I've always wanted to go there. I've stood on the shores of Turkey looking at Greece. I've never been to Greece. There's some areas in Southeast Asia that I haven't been to that I'd love to. So, you know, explorers are big on maps, and in our family room, we have a big world map, and I look at all these islands all over the Pacific Ocean, and you always think, gosh, I wonder what's there. And so I will never travel to all the places I want to. It's a little bit of a disease or an addiction. You know, once you see one place, you want to see more. And then, you know, even within the local place I live in Connecticut. I go hiking a lot and walking, and I'm always seeing new things. And I get as much joy out of seeing a bird that I'm not supposed to see there or any of those things. So I find joy in seeing the outdoors no matter where I am.
And in terms of, so apart from Born to Explore, I want the you've been done you've done lots of, led lots of expeditions. Which ones are the you most proud of?
You know, the project that I'm most proud of isn't even an expedition. It was while I was president of the Explorers Club during COVID. You know, everybody always has time to reflect, especially on walks, on who we as an organization want to be. And I always thought to myself that so many explorers talk about these fantastic people they meet on their trips. Like I was telling you about a woman who was this fantastic teacher. And I also realized that the Explorers Club was very pale and male, and that that didn't represent the world of exploration as well. And so I started this program called the Explorers Club 50, and it means 50 people who are changing the world that the world ought to know about. And I asked explorers to nominate people they had met along the way that they thought, you know, with a little bit of boost could really, you know, amplify their message. And so we're in our fourth year of that, and the results have been stunning. It is, and organically, we've had, you know, oceanographers from Sri Lanka who are women, or women this, or Asian that, or I mean, it's become de facto our diversity and inclusion program. And I guess what I like best about it is all of these classes of 50 have become very close and exchanged information. And so all of these people weren't tokenized or felt that, okay, we invited them in to, you know, make us look good. They were immediately had their own group and which they felt part of. And so I think that's the most satisfying thing I've ever done.
And future-proofing the Explorers Club for generations to come.
Well, you know, as I said, the fabric of exploration or the mosaic of exploration has many different threads. And I think one of the mistakes we have made is if our mission is to promote exploration, you want as many different voices promoting exploration. I may resonate with a certain group of people because of my age, my ethnicity, where I'm from. There may be a kid who grows up in an inner city who I look like I'm from Mars. There's nothing that he or she can relate to in me. And so you want that idea of science being not only through spoken language, but through art and different forms of culture, painters, you know, people who are able to express the world we live in. And so I think the idea of who is an explorer can be expanded to more than Sir Edmund Hillary and Jane Goodall. It's people who are good at explaining the world around them, and that's through unspoken languages like music, dance, art, poetry,
Social media.
social media to some degree. I haven't seen somebody I really gravitate towards, though I guess Greta Thunberg has certainly opened a lot of eyes and through a different methodology. And I think that she would have been poo-pooed by the Royal Geographical Society or the Explorers Club many years ago. And I'm saying good for her. She's living a life that I couldn't. And, you know, she walks the walk.
Yes, I agree. So, where's next on your list? Or have you slowed down?
Well, I do have something that I'm working on now, and I'm always a little hesitant to tell you, but a very good friend of mine who's a underwater archaeologist, the guy who fell off his bike today, we have been finding evidence that Vikings may have visited Cape Cod.
Okay, right.
Around the year 1000, and that we are, I think, on the brink of something big there. And that, again, just shows that humans have been traveling the world a lot further than we once thought. So that's not even that far from where I live. I can get in my car and be there to his home in about 4.5 hours. So that's pretty good. Same time zone. Don't have to have the jet lag issue.
Jet lag. I'm sure you're a pro at jet lag by now.
I am not.
Really?
Everybody thinks there are. And, you know, I remember once there was a year, like in 2006, in a span of 6 months, I'd skied to the North Pole, led a Kilimanjaro trip, and been on Mount Everest for this medical expedition. This is all within a very short time period. And I remember waking up pretty close to the North Pole in my sleeping bag. I thought for a minute, where am I? Where am I? And I sort of realized where I was. And so, you know, everybody always talks about these trips of a lifetime. And I feel like I've been on too many trips of a lifetime.
Not enough. No,
I mean, to be honest, I like waking up in my own bed. I like waking up in my own bed. You know, so you pull the covers up. I've done the sleeping in the wet sleeping bag and the driving snows and, you know, shaking off the frostbite and all that stuff.
I don't believe you, Richard. I don't believe you at all. Thank you for listening to this Big Boat interview. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to tune in every week for news and updates from the Boat Briefing podcast. This episode was mixed and produced by Adam Geist and is a production by Boat International Media. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.